the guidelines are very much about protecting the interests of those who are not very well protected in their rights, very often the poor and the disadvantaged, which in some cases can include women and children. And so they provide a set of statements saying that the question of gender equality in this sense is very important. And that is something that countries have regard to. But it's also something that civil society can use to say, look, you as a global community agreed to these guidelines. They include the question of gender equality. We need to look at this and see how this can be made operational. In some cases, it's to do with changes in laws. In others, it may be to do with the way in which customs and practice take place.
How many countries have agreed to adopt these guidelines?
It's not a question of a signatory to an agreement. It was agreed in the Committee on World Food Security, which is a governing body for the Food and Agriculture Organization. They were carried by consensus, so it's taken an endorsement of the Committee on World Food Security. The Committee on World Food Security, I can't remember the exact number, but has more than 100 member countries, and in many of the negotiations spoke as regions and spoke on behalf of member countries in the regions. So it was a very, very participatory, all-inclusive sort of discussion. And of course, there have been endorsements, as it were, or at least encouragements to adopt the guidelines to countries by many subsequent meetings. So the G20 meeting shortly after the guidelines were endorsed last year encouraged countries to take advantage of the guidelines, as did the Rio Plus 20 meeting, as did the resolution on agriculture of the General Assembly last December. The G8 came out very strongly in favour of the guidelines earlier this year. So there's a lot of very high-level commitment and endorsement encouraging countries and others to move forward to use the guideline as a tool.
How will these guidelines actually help in improving food security?
Well, if you think about it, what you do on your land or in your forest areas or your fisheries is all to do with what sort of security you feel, what sort of rights you feel you have there. And generally speaking, the more secure you feel in your access, the more you're likely to invest. And that, of course, has an impact on how you're going to be able to use the land and what sort of returns you're likely to get in terms of crops and so on and so forth. So I think that's a very important question. But I think it's also very important that in the longer term, as the guidelines get more and more traction, that you mentioned the question of gender and so on and women's access. Well, I think that a broader ownership across genders will be a very important incentive to make land available for both women and men. And this will, I'm sure, also improve production and productivity.
And will it deter practices like land grabbing that have been making headlines?
I think land grabbing is a slightly, we prefer to use the term large-scale land acquisitions. But I think that one of the very important threads of the voluntary guidelines is to address the question of legitimate tenure rights and the protection of legitimate tenure rights. States have a responsibility to protect people's legitimate rights of access and so on to resources. Where you have large-scale acquisitions of land, it is absolutely essential that all of the pre-work is done on that, with communities, with individuals and so on, to ensure that they are properly considered and that any legitimate rights are addressed fully in relation to that. And there's also the question of free, prior and informed consent, which is also an integral part.